The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware. Welcome to WVUD's Campus Voices, weekly conversations with interesting members of the university community, visitors to campus, and others engaged in thought-provoking research and community service. Stay tuned for Campus Voices on WVUD.
Good morning, and welcome to Campus Voices. I'm Richard Gordon, and
I'm Allison Delaney.
And we are talking this morning with Professor Chris Williams from the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources Department of Wildlife and Entomology. Did I say that right?
It's the reverse, entomology and wildlife ecology. Hello.
So one of the things that attracted us to talk to you is that you're in the middle of doing some research right now about what ducks hear. And that is just fascinating.
Yeah, so this is an interesting story. You never know where research will take you. But I do a lot of work with ducks and geese and other upland game birds. And so we do a lot of research on species that are of some kind of conservation concern. And sometimes that's species that are overabundant, like Canada geese in our parks. But a lot of times it's on other species that are struggling. And one of the ducks that has been having a little bit of a hard time is a species called a lesser scaup. And their populations have been on the decline. And they are trying to figure out what sorts of reasons might be causing that decline. And one of them was that these ducks are what we call diving ducks. And so they will dive under the water searching for clams or mussels. And these ducks, we've now noticed, are getting caught up in fishermen's gill nets.
So they're ocean ducks.
Ocean ducks, right. So we split ducks into two categories, dabblers and divers. And so the dabblers, like the mallard that you see in the county park, are always just kind of tipping. You see their butt go up. They're tipping, eating something just a few inches below the water. And these other ducks, these divers, are searching for something a fair ways under the water. So these ocean ducks, which you'll see out in the Chesapeake Bay or in the Delaware Bay when you get to a little bit more open water, are struggling. And so when they start seeing them getting possibly caught up in fishermen's nets, then you ask a simple question, which is, well, how do you prevent that from happening? And one of the obvious answers came from the marine mammals world, which is because porpoises are getting caught up in fishermen's nets as well. And so the federal government actually had initiated an effort a handful of years ago to add what we call pingers to fishermen's nets to try to hopefully deter porpoises from getting caught up in the nets.
So like a little buoy that makes a noise.
Essentially, yeah. And so for like gill nets, there's a couple of ways that you can fish, but a gill net is essentially, it's a hanging net. So the top is got buoys sitting on the surface of the water, and then the net just falls down like a screen into the water, and the fish swim into it, mm-hmm. and they get caught. Their gills get caught, hence the term gill net. And so if you could put pingers somewhere along that net, then hopefully porpoises that are swimming along will say, something doesn't sound right, I should swim the other way. And that was the idea behind it. So given that technology existed, that protocol existed, then we asked the question, well, could this be helpful in deterring ducks? So it seems like a logical question, but then you have to ask a simple question, the next simple question, which is, what frequency of pinger do you need to create for ducks to hear that? And then you have to ask the question, well, do ducks hear? Well, the answer is, of course, ducks hear, but we don't have no idea what they hear. And so we have to sort of, this is, biology takes us in strange directions sometimes, and we have to ask that simple question, figure out what on earth do ducks actually hear.
How do you ask a duck if it heard the beep?
Exactly, right. That's the tricky part. And what's amazing is that you can train ducks to do just that, which is amazing. So we've been working with the U.S. Geological Survey down at Patuxent National Wildlife Refuge in Laurel, Maryland. They have a captive duck population down there. There's only a handful of them in the country. And so they were the ones that initiated this research, and we're working with them. They have these very large dive tanks where you can do stuff. You can test all sorts of things with these captive ducks. And so they do indeed train ducks to basically go through a hearing test. We're used to, we go to our doctor and, you know, find out how our hearing is. They play a song, you know, a sound in our ears, and we raise our hand. So how do you teach a duck to do that exact same thing? Well, they did, which is amazing, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what they did is they, as ducks hatch, these, you know, this captive population, as they hatch, they start training them immediately to get rewards. So they could play a sound, and if they hear the sound, they can train them eventually, if it all goes well, to respond, basically peck a target and say, I heard that. And if they really did hear it, because you can trick them, but if you really played a sound, they really did hear it, they can peck a target and get a piece of food. And you, like I said, you can trick them. You can. They might try to peck when they don't hear a sound. They don't get a target, or they don't get a piece of food. Yeah. So you can just keep doing this over and over and over again, and hopefully train them, which is what they're doing. So yeah.
That's really really interesting. What's the next step after doing that? How did the frequency situation?
Yeah, exactly. So once it goes through this lengthy training process, and so we have a graduate student, Kate McGrew, is working on this, a master's student here doing wildlife ecology. And so she's been training these ducks since they hatch for years. She originally got her undergrad degree down at Maryland, and she started working at USGS, and then we brought her on for this master's. But so she's been working to train these ducks. And it continues to. So as new ducks hatch each year, she trains them. But once you have a duck that has sort of gone through the paces, has proven that it can be trained, because some don't. And so once you have that, then she starts actually going through trials, and she'll play a certain tone, certain frequency, and do it repetitively and see, yes, did they hear that? Yes or no? Okay, now let's go to the next frequency louder, just like, again, the doctor would do for us. Until the point at which the duck basically stops responding to certain frequency levels or certain decibel levels, even different, you know, the strength of the sound, et cetera. So that's the goal. And so she's got a series of ducks of three different species, actually, even though we're really interested in scaw, but there's some others as well. And just hoping that we can build these frequency curves.
You've got the frequency curve built.
Yep.
You know what they can hear.
Right.
How do you do the next step? How do you train them to swim away?
That's the next question that's really hard to figure out. Is as soon as we can figure out what that range of frequencies that they hear, then sure, you can put that into the pingers. The best hope would be, do they hear the same thing that porpoises hear? In which case, you can just reuse the pingers that are already on the market. Very preliminary evidence says that may not be the case. So you're going to have to develop new pingers that do new frequencies. Does that mean the ducks are going to swim away? I don't know. That's the next step to figure out. Then do you actually change their behavior? And that's sort of the next stage in the game. Once we get through and we can figure this out, then you can actually run trials in tanks like this, where you'd say, okay, now let me play that song at them, or that frequency rather, and how do they respond? Does their behavior change at all or not? So that's the next project years down the road.
I'm just fascinated with this. I mean, I know Allie's got other things she wants to ask too, but you've been training these ducks to hit the target and get the food when they hear the sound.
Yeah.
Now you want to train them to do something else.
Right.
Any ideas on how you're going to do that?
Well, and you can't train a wild duck, right? So you're going to have to rely on hopefully finding a piece of technology that they will just naturally respond to. And that's the tricky part, whether they would at all. We don't know. So there's a lot of hope that this will work, not only from the standpoint of the fish nets, but also then you start asking, are there other limitations out there in the environment? Say wind generation that is increasingly starting to be proposed out on offshore. Is there a certain sound that's a problem that is causing ducks to naturally veer away from that? Is that naturally causing them to change their behaviors? Or is it something about, say, naval operations that are making sounds underwater, boats, you know? So there's all these kind of questions that then this can lead to down the road. But those are all, like I said, all next questions down the road.
We're talking with Professor Chris Williams from the University of Delaware's Department of Wildlife Ecology and Entomology. And as you can hear, he's the king of the duckmen down here on campus. Allie, what did you want to ask him?
Well, we were just talking about your work with one grad student. What are some other research studies that you have going on with grad students?
Yeah, so we've had a lengthy list of students who have worked over the years. So I've been here 13 years now, and this last year we started our 28th graduate student. So there's been a lot over the years. They work in a series of areas that relate to this waterfowl and upland game birds. And so there's two directions that this goes. We have students in place that like we just talked about with hearing of ducks. There's been another grad student working at the same facility who's watching duck behaviors in these tanks, and you can record how many calories they burn. Engaging in different activities in these tanks. It's a simple measure where you're pumping in airflow into a tank and an animal breathes in oxygen, expels carbon dioxide. The more active you are, the more carbon dioxide is being exchanged. And so there's these very sensitive pieces of technology that can measure changes in basically energy consumption based on different behaviors. And we're doing all this to figure out, this is a much larger conversation that we've been tackling for a number of years now, to estimate the number of calories that ducks burn in a given day, to get at issues of supply and demand. How much energy is on a landscape? And is that enough energy to keep a duck alive a day? Or to answer a different way, how many thousands of ducks could be supported on a piece of landscape? And it's all about calories and supply and demand. So we've been doing a lot of work trying to just estimate these ideas about caloric intake and caloric availability. So we have one student doing that, and another student also working on this idea of caloric availability off of the New Jersey coastline for goose species. We have a student, the one started last spring, who's working on the breeding success of a duck called the American black duck that has been struggling. And he's working with North Carolina Fish and Wildlife to estimate the success of breeding black ducks down there off the coast. And there are questions of sea level rise and are ultimately habitats going to be in trouble down the road? So if we can figure out where they're nesting, could there be some implications in the future?
You really are looking at all sorts of wildfowl all up and down the northeast coast of the United States. I mean, did you get interested in this because you had family that were duck hunters? Or do you think of the wildfowl as sort of like the canary in the mine, that if the canary is healthy, we can keep mining, but if not, we got to get out?
Yeah.
I mean, what do you think?
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, waterfowl and game birds are one of these suites of wildlife species that have been of high priority and of interest for a century. Some of the earliest species in the country that we were really worried about were the species that were hunted. Hunters were the first conservationists. They're the ones that first were putting the dollars into figuring out how do we maintain populations of wildlife over the long term for generations to come. And so ducks and geese have a very, and upland game birds like bobwhite quail, which is another bird I work with, have had a lot of research done over the last century to help them out. From the standpoint of waterfowl, waterfowl are broken up across the United States into what we call flyways. There's basically four big sections of the country which are essentially highways in the sky, which birds will go to breed in northern North America, all over the place, whether it's northern America or in Canada. And then they'll come south into the lower 48 to winter. And so we here are on the what we call the Atlantic Flyway. So ducks are wintering somewhere along the Atlantic coast. But the Chesapeake Bay, the Delaware Bay, the coast of New Jersey, the sort of mid-Atlantic region is really a hot spot for where ducks and geese winter. And so it's a priority area for us to really study their ecology and their long-term conservation concerns. And so when I came to UD and I was brought in to really bring this game bird component to this program here, it was really with that notion that we knew that we had a high priority area that we needed to work on. And there would be a lot of state government, federal government, non-governmental organizations like Ducks Unlimited or Audubon Society that were really concerned about the populations of these birds. So we're here to help with that.
Other than the work on the East Coast, we know that you've sent some grad students into the Arctic. What was that study all about?
This was an amazing study, an amazing opportunity. So we As a little bit of background, we were focused on a species called the Atlantic brant. And the Atlantic brant is a very small goose. It's not much bigger than a mallard that we all recognize from the county parks again. And they winter here in the mid-Atlantic. While you can find them anywhere from, say, Massachusetts to North Carolina, the bell-shaped curve of wintering Atlantic brant is really the coast of New Jersey. And their populations have been up and down, struggling for the last 30, 40 years. And so there's been a lot of concern about where they're headed in the long run and if we could figure out why they're struggling. And so we started working in the first couple of years I came to UD with New Jersey Fish and Wildlife to ask that question. If we could find anything in the wintering months when they were here hanging out that would cause some kind of limitation. And we spent a lot of time looking at back at this idea of bioenergetics. How much energy demand was there per day for a goose? How much energy supply was there, et cetera? And while we're still working on that, we weren't finding any obvious red flags for why the geese might be struggling here in the winter.
Down here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so then we asked the next question, which was, well, if they're not limited in the winter, if that's not causing the populations to fluctuate or decline, maybe it's happening somewhere else. So maybe it's where they're breeding. So these geese breed in the Arctic. And so specifically, when you go north of Ohio, you go into the Hudson Bay. And eventually you sort of cross a barrier. There's a very large island in the middle of Hudson Bay called Southampton Island. And this is in the Nunavut territories of Canada, the First Nation. And above that is the Northwest Passages, the famous Northwest Passages. And so the Atlantic brant will leave New Jersey, fly up the Hudson River out of New York City, and they'll eventually work their way to James Bay in the southern end of Hudson Bay, and then they'll work their way into Hudson Bay and the Northwest Passages to breed somewhere up in the high Arctic. And we thought, well, maybe there's something going on up there that's causing their populations to decline on the breeding grounds. And there was one sort of very obvious correlative hypothesis we could make, which was that while Atlantic brant populations have struggled, there are two other species of geese that nest in the same area that populations have gone through the roof. So these two geese, one's called a snow goose, so it's a large white goose with black wings. We have some that winter here, but they'll winter all over the United States. And the other is a goose called a cackling goose. And a cackling goose looks just like the Canada goose that we know from our parks, but it's smaller, about half the size. These snow geese and cackling geese winter actually in the Midwest, and then they fly up into these Arctic regions as well. So we know we have two goose species whose populations are exponentially increasing, and then we have another goose species who's struggling. So it might just make sense that correlation is the answer behind this. And that was really the driver behind us heading into the Arctic and trying to look at breeding success or habitat use or behaviors or anything that we could try to figure out if there was some limiting factor to this issue. We did this. We initiated a two-year study, finished a couple years ago, to go up there, and it was initiated by a grad student named Clark Nisley. And he would fly up with a team into the middle of the Arctic on this island called Southampton Island. It's a very very barren area, and right just at the edge of the Arctic Circle. He would get there before the geese arrived, any of these three species out there when the tundra is just covered in ice and snow, set up camp and wait for the geese to show up, and then start watching nesting behaviors or nest success or what habitats are they choosing or how much time are they feeding, are they competing for food, things like that. And what was amazing to us is that when we really paid attention to this, the snow goose was not really part of the story. They were nesting somewhere sort of away from the brant. But the cackling geese were actually nesting and using the exact same spots of habitat that the Atlantic brant were. The really interesting story that showed itself, and this becomes a question of your question of a canary in the coal mine, and that's exactly what I think is happening here, is that Arctic geese breed in a very synchronous way. They, in mass, fly north to the Arctic, and they start breeding within a week. I mean, they've got to time this just perfectly so they can get through a whole nesting cycle and fly out before the Arctic starts freezing up again.
Even with the chicks.
Yeah, right. The chicks have to grow up and get flight feathers and then be able to get out before it all gets bad. But the cackling geese they're slightly bigger geese, and they can leave the Midwest filling up their bellies, get a big tank of fuel essentially on stubble of corn and things like that, and they can essentially beeline it right up into the Arctic. They can fly hard and get up there to take advantage of resources. The Atlantic brant, however, being small, can't make it. So they fill up, get as much resources and fat resources as they can here on the coast in Jersey, work their way up, and by the time they've gotten to James Bay on the southern end of Hudson Bay, they basically have run out of fuel. And they need to spend another week and refueling, eating as much as they can, rebuild fat reserves so they can make the second leg of the journey up into the Arctic. So as a result, the cackling geese tend to show up about 4 to 7 days before the brant do. If you show up earlier, you get first dibs on habitat to nest in, the emergent grass and vegetation to eat, and so you can be healthier. And then when the brant show up, well, all the best spots have been taken. So it's not to say you won't nest, you might, but oftentimes what we'd see is they're nesting, but maybe in areas that weren't as good. Areas that were not as protected against predators. Arctic foxes are a big predator for them. And if you could set up a nest out in the middle of a pond that an Arctic fox can't get to, you're pretty safe. But if you don't have that as an option, you just got a nest on sort of some open mainland, the foxes can get you. So here's the canary in the coal mine story that's very interesting. We had the 2 years that we were up there, there was a very cold year and a very warm year. In that very warm year, the cackling geese arrive, all the ice is melting, they could pick all of the best habitat, the brant show up a handful of days later, and they're relegated to some bad sites off to the side. In the cold year, however, the cackling geese get up there, and they find nothing but ice. There's nothing to choose, and so they hang out for a few days, but since there is no habitat to choose, they actually, a lot of them, gave up. Some flew off somewhere else, hoping to find new habitat. Some stayed put, but the brant then eventually showed up a few days later, and just then did the ice start melting. So all of a sudden, the brant were there at the exact right moment when the ice starts to melt. So I think it's sort of a bet hedging strategy, essentially. The brant, being a smaller goose, know that it takes them a little while to get up there. And of course, they're, since they're smaller, they've burned up all their energy reserves when they finally get onto that landscape. But if they're there with guaranteed emergent vegetation to eat, they'll always have calories just to survive. So then it becomes this question of warm years and cold years and competition. So then that canary in the coal mine is, what about global climate change? If you increasingly have warmer and warmer years, you never have these success years for brant. They brant, always yeah. come up there in essentially warmer and warmer years, and they're always then outcompeted from second one on the landscape.
Wow. That great story was just told us by Professor Chris Williams from the university's Department of Wildlife Ecology. And I think this gets to another point that you talked about with Allie and me when we talked to you on the phone before we started this interview. That's the whole idea of your students not just learning the science, but looking at the intersection with policy and, you know, human behavior.
Yeah, it is such a critical component. One of the things that makes the field of wildlife ecology different from, say, biology, I mean, we're all biologists, we're all ecologists, is that we take it very seriously that we're applied ecologists. If you're going to be successful at conservation, you have to be able to communicate well. You have to be able to provide management implications to the biological research and really then make reasonable suggestions for policy. I teach a class in wildlife policy administration every fall, and it's I think students walk into it thinking this is the last thing that they want to learn. They go into wildlife biology because they want to learn about fuzzy animals and fun things that they learned about on the animal planet, right?
They want to learn if ducks here.
Right, yeah, right. But the last thing they want to learn about is history and policy. But I spend the semester convincing them otherwise, that it is about human dimensions. It is about trying to teach them skills so that they can take basic biology and then really make a difference on the policy front. So when we bring in students, so that's just the undergrad side, but when we bring in graduate students, we're always looking for an answer to the simple question of, what are you going to do after you graduate from your grad school? Well, and the answer should be, well, I'm going to work for a state agency or a federal agency or a non-government organization. Maybe they'll become a college professor, but a lot of times they're working for agencies. They're the folks that are going to be on the front lines of conservation. And they are going to have to deal with people. They're going to have to deal with coming up with management plans. They're going to have to always know how to take that basic biology and apply it to a real result. You know, science for science's sake is fun, but if we're going to make a difference in this world, you got to take it a step further.
I mean, are you going to choose the owl or are you going to choose the timber industry?
Exactly. And the answer is you should choose both. The reality is that humans are a part of nature. We can't remove ourselves from the environment. It's impossible. And so given that we're part of that combination, then we have to figure out some way to create a balance between human needs and ecosystem and nature success. There was a quite a battle in the early part of the 20th century between the famous naturalist John Muir and the first chief of the Forest Service appointed under Teddy Roosevelt, Gifford Pinchot. And John Muir fought for the ideas about preservation, saving nature for nature's sake, and had a religious fervor about it. But Gifford Pinchot took another approach, which said, you need to think about nature. He was a conservationist. He said, you have to look at nature in a different way and think about it as the greatest good for the greatest number of people or for the greatest amount of time. And trying to figure out how do we balance ourselves. That preservation is meaningful, as important, but it can't be the entire piece of the puzzle. So that's the struggle that we deal with every day, and it only becomes a larger struggle every year on this planet.
What opportunities do undergrad students have at the university for research?
You know, it's really important that undergraduates gain additional experience as well. You know, it's all well and good to gain classroom experiences, and we certainly try, and I think it's true for all wildlife science. We try very hard to give undergraduates classes that give them as many hands as possible to pull them up to work in this field, in this career. But it takes so much more. You've got to have real hands-on experience beyond what the classroom can offer. Because, you know, coming into graduate school, and increasingly graduate school is a requirement just to get that good job through the agencies. So to get that graduate career, you've got to be an undergraduate who's been able to gain experiences. And we say to all of our undergraduates, you know, if you can, try to spend your summers going somewhere, anywhere in the United States, in the world, doing wildlife research and really just get out there and get a sense of what it's all about. And that just builds your resume up so much to really gain that next step up. And so while we encourage them to have those summer experiences, one of the great opportunities that we can offer through UD is the idea of undergraduate research and senior theses. And so it's something that I've tried very hard to incorporate into my yearly schedule. And so every year I try to bring in one or two undergraduates to do some sort of senior thesis project. And a lot of times it is a project that's been able to be piggybacked onto one of the other projects that the graduate students are already working on. So they're part of a real world project that's underway. It's funded by an agency. They're really trying to address real concerns and have the undergraduates get involved in that, do some basic science research, but they see the implications of it down the road. And so we've been very lucky over the years to have the students involved in this, and then also take it a step further and build and write peer-reviewed publications so that they can really just take this whole thing to that next step, which is how do I apply my basic research to long-term conservation.
Allie and I noticed on your website that you not just list your own papers and your graduate student papers, but you list several of your undergraduate student papers.
Yeah, it's an honor. I mean, it's a testament to them to give them that opportunity and for so many of those students to see them blossom and then they go on into graduate school and I see them going on into careers. You know, that's why we're here. And boy, it's a reward to have them be part of the program.
Thank you, Professor Williams,
for
joining us. It's so interesting.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and do not necessarily reflect the official views of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archived episodes, visit our website, www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.